Mr. Seagrass, good morning to you.
Good morning.
You may approach.
Thank you, Mr. Chief Justice. Your Honors, may it please the Court, my name is Jonathan Seagrass of Legal Aid of Nebraska, appearing on behalf of the appellant and mother, Tara. This case is about whether ICLA and NICLA apply in minor guardianship proceedings. Tara contends that it does, and as a result, several things were required prior to the appointment of a guardian in this case. A failure to comply with any of these requirements is reversible error. However, here, none of the things required by ICLA and NICLA were correctly done, and most were not done at all. As a result, this court must vacate the decision of the county court and remand to the county court with instructions to decline any further jurisdiction in this case and return the child to her mother unless doing so would result in substantial and immediate danger or threat of such danger to the child.
What was the problem, if you will, that prompted Congress in the beginning to pass the Indian Child Welfare Act?
My recollection is Congress found that an alarmingly high number of Indian children were being removed from the placement of their families and from their tribe and their tribal cultures for placement in the home of non-Indian settings, and that this not only was not in the best interests of Indian children, but not in the best interests of Indian families, not in the best interests of tribes, and therefore the federal government decided to enact minimum federal standards designed to address those and the other problems that Congress saw.
And one of the preferred outcomes of that legislation is placement with someone in the broader family. Is that not correct?
That's correct. ICWA and NICWA
and
provide.
Isn't that what happened here?
Yes, the guardianship, the effect of it was that the child was placed with extended family. ICWA and NICWA apply in this case because minor guardianship proceedings in this proceeding fit the definition of a foster care placement as defined in ICWA and NICWA. Foster care placement being one of the types of child custody proceedings that ICWA and NICWA say it applies to. That definition says it applies to any action removing an Indian child from his or her parent for placement in the home of a guardian where the parent cannot have the child returned upon demand, but where the parental rights are not terminated. Nothing in that definition of foster care placement limits the application of ICWA to cases in which the child is placed outside of the extended family. And, Your Honors, several states have addressed the issue which it appears Your Honor is alluding to about whether ICWA applies in cases in which the child is placed still with a family member.
And in this case, the grandparents.
Yes. Yes, the grandparents.
And the grandfather was a member of the tribe. Is that correct?
That is correct, Your Honor. And most courts that have decided whether ICWA applies in cases in which it could be considered to be an intra-family dispute have determined that it does in fact apply. Two of those cases are In re AKH from the Minnesota Court of Appeals and In re QGM from the Oklahoma Supreme Court, cases which I have cited for other reasons in my principal case in chief. And Your Honors, ICWA applies whenever there is an Indian child and a child custody proceeding as child custody proceeding is defined in ICWA. Here, the definition of foster care placement includes minor guardianship proceedings. At least six states, have held that ICWA does apply to minor guardianship proceedings. I'm unaware of any states that have held to the contrary. The current version of the Bureau of Indian Affairs guidelines, which this court has held is persuasive evidence in applying the provisions of ICWA and NICWA, states that ICWA does apply to minor guardianship proceedings. For these reasons, ICWA and NICWA apply in this case to the same extent that it would apply in any foster care placement. And that means that in this case, four primary things were required. First, the county court was required to appoint an attorney for the mother upon a showing that the mother was indigent. Here, Tara, on two occasions, made written requests for court-appointed counsel to the county court.
Did the county court deny the request for counsel based on a finding that ICWA and NICWA did not apply, or based on a finding that Tara had not demonstrated indigency?
The county court did not deny it based upon a finding that she wasn't indigent. The county court did say at one time that it was denied because she didn't necessarily get an attorney in guardianship proceedings. And she also said that that Tara did not go about requesting an attorney in the correct way.
How did she go about requesting? Was it through letters sent to the court?
First, she filed a pleading with the court invoking the provision of the Indian Child Welfare Act that allows her a court-appointed attorney making statements about her inability to afford counsel, providing information that the only income that she had at the time was food stamps and Medicaid assistance, and that she was unable to afford an attorney.
What's the basis for an indigency showing in the first place?
ICWA and NICWA do not give any definition of the term indigent. By any plain meaning of that term, it's clear in this case that Tara is indigent and unable to afford counsel and entitled to a court-appointed attorney.
If ICWA and NICWA don't provide direction, how should trial courts go about determining indigency? Do they borrow it from some other statutory regime where indigency is at issue? What's a court to do?
Courts would need to apply the plain meaning of that term as it is present in the statute. The evidence presented throughout this case is that Tara had, her only income was food stamp assistance and Medicaid assistance. There was never any evidence indicating that she had income, that she in some other way was able to afford an attorney. No evidence at all.
How was she paying for college?
I believe the record indicates that she had taken out loans to allow her to pay the costs of college, Your Honor.
If we were to find that the only ground, if we were to assume that ICWA and NICWA apply, but the only problem was the appointment of counsel, would the remedy be, as you suggested at the outset, that we remand with directions to dismiss the guardianship proceeding, or would the outcome be we remand with directions to hold a new hearing with Tara having been appointed counsel?
Your Honor, 25 U.S.C. 1920 and Nebraska Revised Statute 43-15-12 and the regulations implementing the federal statute indicate that if a court finds that a child has been improperly removed from his or her parent, the court must decline further jurisdiction of the case and remand the case for instructions, and must decline further jurisdiction of the case and return the child to the parent unless doing so would result in serious emotional or physical harm. And the denial of counsel to Tara is something that certainly prejudices her in this case. The regulations implementing ICWA indicate that the notice that was required to be given to Tara state that she has a right to court-appointed counsel. The regulations state that if a parent appears in court without an attorney, the judge is supposed to advise that person of their right to an attorney, and the court's not being not having the assistance of an attorney when one is required by law certainly would make it much more difficult for her to have her case heard. And if the notice was given that said she had a right to a court-appointed attorney, if the county court judge would have advised her of a right to an attorney, likely she would have been appointed one. It would have been difficult for the court or for the appellee to argue that she wouldn't have one. It would have been difficult for her to invoke the provisions of the Indian Child Welfare Act, which she tried to do here, but unsuccessfully.
Counsel, when this proceeding began, wasn't the child living with the grandparents?
That's correct, Your Honor.
So when the proceeding began,
the child would not have been removed from the parent or Indian custodian. In fact, they were already with and remained with an Indian custodian. Isn't that true?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I would disagree, I disagree that the child would have not been removed. The guardianship removed legal custody of Tara's daughter from her and placed legal custody of that child in the home of her parents. This court, in re interest of Shayla H., in 2014, held that ICWA still applies to a case, or held that ICWA applied in a case in which the Nebraska Department of Health and Human Services had not removed the child from the parent, but had sought removal of legal custody of the child from the parent for placement in the care of the Nebraska Department of Health and Human Services. That case is similar to this one in the sense that legal custody is what was removed here,
But not removed from an Indian custodian.
Well, removed from the Indian child's parent, and I believe that the definition of foster care placement says that it applies in any action removing an Indian child from his or her parent.
Or, I mean, the statute goes on to say, or Indian custodian. How do we reconcile that with this particular fact situation?
Your Honor, Indian custodian is a term that is defined in ICWA and NICWA, and my understanding is the definition describes an Indian custodian as somebody who has legal custody of the child pursuant to tribal law, tribal custom, or state law. Here, the appellee would not have had legal custody to the child prior to the guardianship, and therefore the appellee is not an Indian custodian.
But your argument doesn't depend on the Indian custodian, does it? Your argument is that the guardianship removed legal custody from the parent.
Yes, Your Honor, based on the provisions of the definition of a foster care placement. Whether or not it removed the child from the home of an Indian custodian, it certainly removed the child from the legal custody of her parent. For placement in the home of a guardian, she can't have the child returned to her upon demand. She would have to petition the county court to do so, but her parental rights have not been terminated. Your Honors, I see I'm out of time. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Ms. Albertson, good morning to you.
Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Ashley Albertson from Smith, Gillespie, Torin, and Rogers, and I am here representing the appellee and grandmother, Susan. Your Honors, this case, well, appellant has asserted that this case involves NICWA and ICWA. That is an incorrect assertion. ICWA, by its definition and purpose, is to protect the best interests of Indian children through the establishment of minimum standards for the removal of an Indian child from their families. The purpose of NICWA is to clarify state policies and procedures regarding the implementation by the state of Nebraska of the Federal Indian Child Welfare Act.
So who had legal custody of the child in question when this guardianship proceeding was commenced?
At the start, prior to the emergency order, the mother had legal custody of the child but did not have physical custody of the child because she had ceded that to the grandparents by allowing the child to stay there, arguably. But she did have legal custody.
So your argument is that NICWA and ICWA simply don't apply, even where a Native American parent has legal custody and the proceeding would take away that legal custody?
Your Honor, my argument is that ICWA and NICWA don't apply when the state is not a party. That the burdens placed on individuals would be significantly too high, that there was no intent to apply ICWA and NICWA to proceedings that were purely private.
Where do you get that in the statutory language?
I get that from the purpose. I get that from the plain reading of the guardianship statutes involving ICWA and NICWA that state and I apologize for the sentence.
Have we ever said differently?
This court has never ruled on whether ICWA and NICWA apply in a private guardianship. All cases in this state involving ICWA and NICWA have been involving a state action.
Have we held that it applies in private adoption proceedings? In re Micah H, perhaps?
But this is a different situation because that is a permanent removal. This is a temporary.
But isn't your argument that the purpose is only when the state of Nebraska is involved? And why wouldn't your argument apply just as much to the Micah H situation, and have we already rejected it in that case?
I would argue that you've not rejected it because the specific issue that we're dealing with here is the guardianship. The appellant is arguing that the guardianship, that the guardian-specific language means that our client, as the proposed guardian, has to meet these extended burdens, when in fact they don't. The specific language of what's required here actually states a concerted level of casework. In fact, point 8 under Nebraska Revised Statute 43.283.01 actually says the department or state must provide a written report of the active efforts attempt.
But aren't those same active efforts requirements applicable in an adoption proceeding? And doesn't Micah H, didn't we hold that was required in a private adoption?
But again, we fall back on the issue of an adoption is a permanent termination of a parent's rights.
Why does that make a difference?
Because here that's not an issue. Here there is actually the ability for Tara, the appellant, to get her child back at any point. All she has to do is petition the court. That is actually the possibility of an immediate return of a child. She simply has to go to the court to do so.
This is not
a permanent removal.
I apologize, but I'm still not following why that makes a difference as to whether active efforts are required or why that should impact our interpretation of the foster care placement language in 3A.
Because ICWA doesn't apply if there's not a state actor. This is not an adoption proceeding. This is a guardianship proceeding. Guardianships in their nature are temporary. The court made that clear. The trial court made that clear to Tara before making its ruling.
What about section 3E, when it's speaking of voluntary foster care placement, says it shall mean a non-court-involved proceeding in which the department or the state is facilitating a voluntary foster care placement. What would be the reason for including the specific language about the department or the state if all actions under ICWA have to involve the department or the state?
I believe that the statute was to make it very clear who was responsible for doing those things, not to create an assumption that only the state wasn't involved in every aspect, but who specifically had to do that? Who specifically is responsible for something?
How would you respond to the argument, if tendered by your opponent, that the ordinary course of statutory interpretation takes the plain language of the statute and you don't add words to the statute, and that the 3A definition of foster care placement doesn't use the word state action, it says any action?
The issue with that is that then we revert back to there's no removal from a guardian or custodian in this case, or a parent or custodian in this case. We're not adding words. We're asking that this court clarify that it has to be a state actor because the entire ICWA and NICWA is presupposed to involve the state based on its purpose.
What's the weight of authority around the country with state courts interpreting ICWA or their state counterparts with respect to your argument?
It seems like there's a mixed bag here. Some states have said it doesn't involve, like, we're not going to get involved if it's intrafamily, just do what you need to do. Some states have taken the stance that we want our version of ICWA, whatever that state is, to apply even in an intrafamilial guardianship. We're in a unique position here. It might apply, it might not apply. Our argument is it doesn't apply because the burdens that 43.283.01 would put on a family to protect a child are simply too high and creates an inference based on the purpose of ICWA and NICWA that the state would be an actor here.
Did your client take the wrong action here? Should she simply have called up the Department of Health and Human Services and said, we think we've got a child in danger and you need to be involved?
So it's unclear from the record whether or not that was done or not. And unfortunately, since that's not where we are, if we presuppose that she, if we say hypothetically that she had called CPS and made a complaint, there's no guarantee that they would have taken any action. The child was already placed with the grandparents. So we would have had to force CPS to come out and investigate when the child was safe in that moment. So there would be a question of whether CPS would have even taken action.
What's the rationale for requiring a state that ICWA would apply upon adoption, but it would not apply in these temporary placements? What would be the logic of that in view of the purpose?
Well, number one, this involves the child staying with the family. This guardianship involves specifically a child remaining in the home that she was raised in with the people she was raised with, and there's no permanent removal from the parent. In the future, were Tara able to mitigate her issues, get herself back on track, she could have come back and said, I would like my daughter back, could have petitioned the court and gotten her child back. In an adoption proceeding, that's not an option. She can't make the changes that she needs to make and get her child back, and the child is permanently removed from the family. An adoption completely cuts off, assuming an adoption by a non-family member would completely cut off the child from the family. We are again asking you to find that the trial court was correct, affirm the decision of that court, and I would cede my last minute unless the court has any further questions.
Assuming ICWA and NICWA do apply, you've made an argument, you make an argument that even if they do apply, that the county court complied with them in all respects. I'd like to ask you about your argument that there was compliance with the provision that requires expert testimony.
Yes.
Your position is that Tara herself is the expert?
Yes. Specifically, she has a background in Native American studies. She's testified on her own behalf that she speaks Cherokee, that she works for the Omaha Public Schools, or held a position that's unclear if it was paid.
But did she provide testimony that, yes, in my expert opinion, this child should be taken, legal custody of this child should be taken away from me?
She testified that that she was sleeping for 12 to 36 hours a day, that when she was sleeping or out.
But that sounds like fact testimony rather than expert testimony.
She could still testify as to her opinion without blatantly stating, this is my opinion. There's no case law that I am aware of that states that the opinion has to start with, in my opinion. She gave her testimony, and the fact that the court took the correct assumption that, hey, this checks all the boxes.
So you're relying on Tara and her fact testimony about the care or lack of care she provided. Is that fair to say?
I am relying on her expert testimony as a member of the tribe and someone who was well-versed in the cultural norms of that tribe. That's what I'm relying on. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Do we have time for rebuttal?
No, Your Honor.
There is no time for rebuttal, so that concludes arguments on this case and actually concludes arguments for the court today. So what we're going to do right now is open this up for questions. Counsel, you may stay or go as you